Radio Portus Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You're listening to the sound of universal compassion. Today we will continue listening to Tangent's PBS program with the book Way of Life by Shanti Davies. Please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3 or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association. Respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello and welcome once again to Shantideva and his text, The Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. I hope your week has gone extremely well, or if it hasn't, you found the courage to deal with its difficulties warm-heartedly and compassionately. Those of you who were with us last time may remember that we ended the program with a quote from Thich Nhat Hanh, the great Vietnamese master. He talked about when meditating on the interdependent nature of all things, we come to realize the fears, anguish, hopes, and despair of all beings. When that realization becomes strong within us, our separations dissolve, and if we harm another, we feel directly as though we've harmed ourselves. I have a meditation class in Auckland Hospital with students and staff of the University Medical School. And a little while ago, one evening we meditated on Tonglen, the practice of taking on our own and others' suffering and giving our happiness to others. We had done this meditation before, and one of the ladies in the class had made it a regular practice. On this particular evening, in the discussion after the meditation, she said that she had just suddenly realized that there is no individual suffering, that suffering is just suffering, and happiness is just happiness. She had made the interdependent connection between all beings, and it had moved her profoundly. As Thich Nhat Hanh continues in his quote, "The interdependence of all beings is not a philosophical game removed from spiritual and practical life. In bringing to light the interdependence of all phenomena, the meditator comes to see that the lives of all beings are one, and he or she is overcome with compassion for all. When you feel this love, you know that your meditation is bearing fruit. Seeing and loving always go together. Seeing and loving are one. Shallow understanding accompanies shallow compassion. Great understanding goes with great compassion." And he talks about watching a wildlife show in which predators hunt other animals for food. The tiger hunts the deer and the snake hunts the frog. As we watch, we hope that the deer will escape and the frog will be saved, because it is painful to watch their suffering, he writes. But we don't often consider that the tiger and the snake must also eat to live. We humans eat chickens, pigs, shrimp, fish and cows, and like the tiger and the snake, even deer and frogs. Yet because it is painful to watch, we take the side of the prey and hope it will escape. In these situations, as meditators, we must remain very clear. We cannot take either side, because we exist in both. If a scene like this were occurring in front of us, we would try to find a way to save the deer and frog. But we have to be careful not to do this just to avoid our own anguish. We must also feel the pain of the tiger or the snake, deprived of food, and have compassion for them. The more deeply we penetrate into life, the more we see its miracles, and the more we see its heartbreaking and terrifying events. Now, the verse in Shantideva's text that inspired this discussion, you may remember, came from the chapter on meditation. The main thrust of the chapter is the practice of exchanging our self-cherishing attitude with the attitude of cherishing others. That means, instead of putting ourselves first and foremost, as we usually do, we make others the main concern of our life, trying to alleviate all their sufferings and bring them happiness. The verse presents an objection to taking on the responsibility to stop the suffering of all beings. The objection relies on the Buddhist understanding of reality that ultimately nothing exists inherently and independently, and says that therefore, as really neither the sufferer nor the suffering really exists, why worry about relieving the suffering? But in reply, Shantideva implies that it's all very well to talk about the non-existence of suffering in an ultimate sense, but conventionally we do suffer, and there's no getting away from that. And as we're all in the same boat, we should try to help all others. If we don't help others because suffering ultimately doesn't exist, we shouldn't then want to be free of our own suffering, since it too doesn't really exist. Of course, nobody in their right mind will just sit around with lots of suffering and not do anything about it, because, oh well, it ultimately doesn't really exist. In any case, as Thich Nhat Hanh indicates, and the student in my class has realized, suffering is not individual, it is universal. So just focusing on our own dilemmas creates more pain, while focusing our compassion on the suffering of all helps to relieve the suffering of all. And now, before we proceed any further, how about setting a motivation for the program as usual? Once again, bringing our intent onto the suffering of all beings, let's make our motivation the mind of bodhicitta, the mind that wishes to attain enlightenment to benefit not only ourselves, but all living beings. That means, of course, relieving them of all their sufferings and bringing them both short and long-term happiness. So let's take a moment to set such a motivation. Thank you. Now continuing with the Shantideva text, verses 104 and 105 of this chapter go like this. But since this compassion will bring me much misery, why should I exert myself to develop it? Should I contemplate the suffering of living creatures, how could the misery of compassion be more? If by one person suffering, the suffering of many would be destroyed, surely kind-hearted people would accept it for the sake of themselves and others. The first verse brings out another objection, that as taking on others' misery will just intensify my own suffering, what's the point of doing so? But, answers Shantideva, how can your considering others' suffering be greater than that suffering? You are only one person, others are countless, so your suffering cannot compare with the totality of misery. And then in the second verse, he points out that if the suffering of many beings could be relieved by the suffering of one person, wouldn't any warm-hearted person gladly take on that suffering? In her commentary, Pema Chodron writes, I frequently hear this response to the practice of putting oneself in another's shoes. It's a conventional argument against experiencing the pain of others. The opponent of pity, a better word might be empathy or compassion, says, I can't bear my own suffering, let alone someone else's. But Shantideva replies that the sting of empathy is nothing compared to the suffering, the hunger, thirst, violence, neglect, and fundamental ignorance of sentient beings. The pain of compassion can make us decidedly more loving and tender-hearted towards others. Certainly it hurts not to shut out their pain, but it heals the even greater pain of self-absorption. And in response to the second verse, she tells the story of a meditator on Tonglen, the practice of giving and taking I mentioned earlier on in the program. She writes, someone asked a Tibetan Lama if he was afraid that by breathing in others' suffering, doing Tonglen meditation practice, he would catch it. To this he replied that nothing would make him happier than to take on their pain so that they could be free of it. When someone can say this, a profound shift has taken place. His greatest happiness comes from realizing the equality of himself and others. Whatever pain he experiences in the process is not a deterrent. Some programs back, I talked about my personal experience with this kind of practice when sitting in the dentist's chair. I had to have a tooth filled, but I think that injections do more harm than good, so told the dentist, no anesthetic. While he did his work, I prayed that since I had to undergo this discomfort, I would also experience all other beings' sufferings and they would be free. I visualized this happening, and although there was some pain in my jaw, my mind remained very peaceful, calm, and happy. After all was done, I left the dental clinic without any residual pain at all. So much of our suffering comes from anticipation and unwillingness to accept a painful situation. We make things so intense that the suffering becomes almost overwhelming. However, when we step out of our self-absorption and open our minds to the suffering of all others, we might experience some pain, but our suffering is hugely relieved. We don't see a difference between pain and suffering until, as Pema Chodron says, we really put ourselves in others' shoes, and then we might realize that although the pain may be great, the suffering may not be. His Holiness writes in his commentary, "We might think, if I meditate on compassion and think of the suffering of others, it will only add to the intense pain I already have." We only think like this because we are narrow-minded. If we do not want to help beings, then their suffering will be endless. But if we can develop a little compassion and make an effort to dispel the suffering of others, then that suffering will have an end. Without our taking the responsibility to help others, there can be no limit to suffering. When we develop a broad mind and feel compassion for others, this is vastly beneficial. Any small difficulties we might experience are worthwhile. And he goes on to point out that the great bodhisattvas are prepared to do anything, even lose their lives, if it will eradicate the misery of numerous other beings. In the next verse, Shantideva talks about one bodhisattva who actually did give his life to help many others. Thus, the bodhisattva Supush Chandra, although aware of the harm the king would cause him, accepted his own suffering in order to eradicate the miseries of many. The example comes out of the Samadhi Raja Sutra. In his commentary, The Nectar of Manjushri's Speech, Kunzan Peldon tells the story like this. At a time when the doctrine of an earlier Buddha, Ratnapadmachandra, was in decline, the monk Supush Chandra lived together with a host of 7,000 bodhisattvas in the forest called Sumantabhadra. He was gifted with second sight, and he knew that if he were to go and teach in the jeweled palace of the king Viradatta, many millions of beings would gain high rebirth or liberation in the state of a non-returner. On the other hand, he knew that if he went, the king would kill him. And so he went to the palace and fasted for 7 days. At night he circumambulated a stupa that contained the fingernails of one of the Buddhas, and during the day he taught at all the villages around. He placed an inconceivable number of beings in the higher realms and in the level of non-returners. After he died, killed on the orders of the king by Udayana the executioner, the king himself repented, Supush Pachandra's bones, and made offerings before it. And so Shantideva continues, "Thus, because he loves to pacify the pains of others, he whose mind is attuned in this way would enter even the deepest hell, just as a wild goose plunges into a lotus pool. Will not the ocean of joy that shall exist when all beings be free be sufficient for me? What am I doing wishing for my liberation alone?" His Holiness comments, "For a bodhisattva who wears the armor of determination, the joy he has from alleviating the pain of infinite beings is sufficient on its own, even if he suffers a little in himself. How could achieving liberation for ourselves alone, while abandoning our promise to liberate others, be better than that?" Well, now that's all very well, but for most of us, the mere contemplation of a state where we feel like our body, tender as an infant's, is boiled in acid in an environment like the middle of the sun, is enough to make us shy violently away. So we probably can't think about entering into the worst kind of hell, like a goose enters a lotus pool for the sake of others. For myself, I dread even a bad dream, and when I have one, I'm very thankful to wake up and see the sun shining on another earthly day. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't at least aspire to one day in a future life even to be able to bear the worst hell for others' sake. As Pema Chodron writes, Could we become fearless enough to venture into places of unremitting agony? Could we do this as enthusiastically as swans sweep down upon a lotus lake? Nothing gave Mother Teresa more pleasure than relieving suffering. Happiness for her was helping people to die, knowing they weren't alone. You and I are like fledglings just learning to fly. We can foster the heart of Bodhi in smaller ways. Giving a beggar money with the enthusiasm of those swans would be a major step forward. I've benefited greatly from Shantideva's advice to start with little cares and minor challenges and let daring unfold naturally. This isn't playing it safe. It's the wisdom of starting with what's doable and expanding our courage a little bit at a time. If you've ever wondered how to get there from here, this teaching provides the answer. In earlier chapters, Shantideva's instructions were primarily for working with our personal confusion. Building on that foundation, he now emphasizes a more advanced stage of our journey. It's always wise, however, to use the teachings that apply to where you are right now as your guide to daily living. This is the way to avoid discouragement and burnout. And now Shantideva uses this contemplation of the joy we get helping others to warn us not to get above ourselves because of it. Therefore, although working for the benefit of others, I should not be conceited or consider myself wonderful. And because of the joy there is in solely doing this, I should not hope for any ripening effect. Therefore, just as I protect myself from unpleasant things, however small, in the same way I should act towards others with a compassionate and caring mind. Perhaps the easiest way to appreciate what Shantideva says is to think of our relationship to animals, writes Pema Chodron. It's not that complicated. We will happily save an animal from a cruel situation, not to be seen as virtuous, but just to guard and shield the animal from pain. We might easily be more protective of their welfare than our own. Now, perhaps I shouldn't put this story in the program, but it illustrates both what Shantideva and Pema Chodron write about. It comes from an American website called Sun Bear Squad, which aims to, and I quote, transform animal lovers into animal welfare defenders with knowledge, tools, and inspiration. The inspiration part includes some stories of animal rescues, and the one I've chosen is about a pit bull puppy left in freezing weather. The story says 15 degrees, but that's Fahrenheit. In Celsius, that's around minus 9 or 10. So it was pretty cool. Perhaps it would be a good idea to have a few tissues handy because it's one of those weepy stories. I've listed it straight off this website and it goes like this. It was bitterly cold, somewhere around 15 degrees, the day my sister Melissa agreed to help her friend move. It had snowed the night before and was snowing again when they arrived at her duplex. Melissa had gone through the sliding doors into the backyard to throw something into the trash can when she heard whining in the yard next door. By standing on the porch, she could see over the 6-foot wooden fence. She was horrified to see a puppy chained to a picnic table in the yard. The puppy was so skinny you could count every rib and she was shivering fiercely. She asked her friend about the dog and was told not to worry about it, that it was out there all the time and would be fine. My sister wasn't just going to leave this puppy to die, and so after not getting a response by knocking on the neighbor's door, she grabbed a blanket from her car and went through a gate into the backyard. She was going to leave the dog with a blanket and call the Humane Society until she saw that the chain that attached the dog to the table was only 2 feet long and was heavily embedded into the little one's neck. Melissa disconnected the chain from the table and, scooping the puppy into the blanket, hopped into the car and headed to our vet clinic. The puppy was very weak and malnourished and had to be treated for hypothermia. The chain had to be cut out of her neck. She was put on antibiotics and pain meds. She was just 2 months old and was a gorgeous red and white pit bull terrier. Melissa brought her home to foster her. She was only a foster for a week before my family decided to make her a permanent addition and named her Ruckus. She's now 4 years old and gets along with everyone and everything, including her best friend, a 5-pound calico cat named Fiona. You would never know that her life hasn't always been filled with love, and the scars on her neck are the only reminder of her past. Ruckus was grand champion in a 4-H rally this year with our youngest sister. Now Ruckus works with physically and mentally disabled children as a therapy dog. Without that split-second decision that my sister made to save her life, the children and families who love Ruckus would never have known how great rescued dogs are. The special moments where she's been laying on the ground surrounded by happy, laughing kids would have never happened. Our lives are truly happier and fuller because of her, and she's a true ambassador for her breed. It is this kind of spontaneous kind action that can lay the basis of realizing the aspiration to benefit all beings. Of course, many people are kind and rescue and look after distressed animals. But for how many is it part of an intentional step to develop bodhicitta? The reason we do a short motivation for the radio program each week is that motivation makes an action positive or negative, and the vaster the motivation, the greater the positive potential on the mind. So rescuing an animal with a pure compassionate mind brings a lot of positive potential, but the same action with a mind of bodhicitta creates a much greater positive potential. However, as Shanti Davis says, by thinking, this positive potential I'm creating is going to benefit me a lot in the future, just spoils the action. So our intention has to be purely to benefit others, without any regard for ourselves, as the lady in this story demonstrated. And now Shanti Davis takes another tack in the argument for thinking, equalizing self with others. Although the basis is quite impersonal, through constant familiarity, I've come to regard the drops of sperm and blood of others as I. So in the same way, why should I be unable to regard the bodies of others as I? Hence, it is not difficult to see that my body is also that of others. And this body of ours was formed through the coming together of the sperm and blood of our father and mother. We have such a close affinity and attachment for it that we identify very strongly with it as me. I hurt myself, says the little boy who lost control of his bicycle and landed up in a thorn bush. And that's an example from my own history. But actually, says Shanti Deva, the sperm and blood and the resultant body are quite impersonal. Kunzang Peldon interprets these verses in his commentary like this. People will say it's impossible to consider other beings as oneself, that such a mental attitude will never happen. But it will. In respect of ourselves, the drops of semen and blood belonging to our parents are completely alien and do not have the slightest existence as things belonging to us that could serve as a basis of either liberation or deluded samsaric existence. Nevertheless, it is through sheer force of habit that we've come to have a sense of I in relation to them. Since we are able to identify as our bodies and minds things that are devoid of such an I identity, why should it be difficult to identify the bodies of other people, which are also of the nature of generative substances of their parents, as I, and grow used to such a perspective? And vice versa, why, as a result of habituation, should it be difficult for us to think of this body of ours as though it belongs to someone else? Well, naturally, from our current perspective, it might seem like lunacy to try and regard other people's bodies as our own. The thought that the unrelenting mosquito, intent on taking a meal out of me, is actually me, may be very strange indeed. But as we, through pure habituation, came to associate so strongly with the sperm and blood of our parents, and what that combination led to, why can't we use habituation to associate with others in the same way? Pema Chodron takes a more conventional approach in showing how we can exchange ourselves for others. She writes, the relentless sense of me and mine is an acquired habit, the strongest habit we have. Realizing the absurdity of this, Is it too comical to think of I as someone else and not me? If this I is insulting someone, is it too big a stretch to imagine how the other person feels? If we were to literally exchange places for even an instant, we would feel the full force of our own cruel words and without a doubt instantly stop hurting them. Now, some people who have had near-death experiences report that as their lives flashed before them, they saw their hurtful actions to others and actually went through the pain that those actions had caused. So it's not inconceivable that we have the capacity to experience what others go through and use it as a basis to exchange our self-cherishing attitude for one that puts the focus on others. His Holiness writes, "The exchange of self and others is a practice that consists of putting ourselves in the place of others and putting others in our own place. If we train in this, we come to consider others more important than ourselves, so that their happiness and suffering become more important than ours. And when they are harmed, we feel it as acutely as when we ourselves are harmed. This is not difficult to do once we have realized the disadvantages of thinking only of ourselves and the benefits of cherishing others. Our exchange of self and others becomes so vivid and strong that it's easy for us to give our lives for others. And by others, we mean all beings, everywhere." Shantideva continues, "Having seen the mistakes in cherishing myself and the ocean of good in cherishing others, I shall completely reject all selfishness and accustom myself to accepting others. In the same way as the hands and so forth are regarded as limbs of the body, likewise, why are embodied creatures not regarded as limbs of life?" In accordance with this, Thich Nhat Hanh made a beautiful answer to a question by a young man who was having difficulty relating to his father. Thich Nhat Hanh said, "Usually we think that the other person is outside of us. That's not the right view. In this case, we think that our father is outside of us, and we need only to change the outside and not the inside. We need to see that our father is in us. Our father is present in every cell of our body. We are the continuation of our father. It may be easier for us to change our father inside first, and we can do that 24 hours a day. You don't need to go and see him, talk to him, in order to change. The way we breathe, the way we walk, can change him in ourselves. Invite him to walk with us, to sit with us, to smile with us, and the father inside of us will change. Otherwise, we will grow up and behave exactly like him. There are many children who hate their father, who promise that when they grow up, they will not act and say things like their father. But when they grow up, they will act exactly like their father and will say things exactly like their father. That has happened many times. You hate it, you don't want to do it, you don't want to say it, and yet you will do exactly that and you will speak exactly like that. In Buddhism, that is what we call samsara, going around. You continue your father not only with your body, but with your way of life. That is why when you encounter the Buddha Dharma, you have a chance to change your father in you first. When you've been able to change your father inside of you, he will not go to samsara again, and you will not transmit that kind of habit to your children. So you end the round of samsara going around recycling. When the father inside has been transformed, the transformation of the father outside will be much easier. That is my experience. And now time is up and we must part. Please dedicate any positive energy from the program to the enlightenment of all beings. Thank you, and I hope you'll join us again next week. Goodbye. This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3, or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering.